WX is supported by Mountain Flame in Arkville, featuring a range of products for home heating solutions. A variety of fireplaces, wood stoves, and gas and pellet stoves are available and on display. For sales and service, Mountain Flame in Arkville, warming home since 1980. Details at mountainflame.com.
WIOX is supported by Kriya, a store designed as a source for sustainable artisanal products, including Kriya's own jewelry made from reclaimed metals and ethically produced goods to wear and share. Kriya, K-R-I-A, on Main Street in Margaretville. More information at kriyajewelry.com.
Greetings, this is Mario Murillo. I'm the host of Rumba Therapy, a musical journey featuring the diverse sounds and rhythms of the Americas with their foundations in the Afro-Indigenous European experience of the hemisphere. From classic salsa to cumbias, merengue to commercial fusions, and many surprises in between. Rumba Therapy, alternate Friday evenings from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on WIOX Roxbury, community radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20, and online at WIOXradio.org.
Okay, you're listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and everywhere at WIOXradio.org, where it's easy to donate if you like what you hear. You can also get WIOX on any smart device through the FM radio apps. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John, how's it going?
Things are good. How are you?
I'm fine, John. You know?
Spring is here.
Spring is here.
There's flowers out. First day of trout season.
Saw a guy fishing.
I saw several today.
I saw a guy fishing yesterday, though. So that kind of...
Jumping the gun.
I wanted to say, hey, man. But that's okay.
Yeah. I guess the local season's always open.
Right.
I don't know.
Right. Hey, there's Clorox disinfecting wipes right in front of me.
Wow, what is that? Haven't seen that.
These things got to be worth like $100.
I know. You know, it's a great time for marketing managers, I guess, and companies, because I went to a store the other day and there was quite a few wipes on the shelf, but they were this weird scented. It was like a raspberry lemon something that I normally would never buy, but there they were on the shelf.
Beggars can't be choosers, John.
See me begging?
I don't know. Were you?
No. But yeah. I do have one in my hand right now.
Yeah, man. So, what else? Oh, yeah. Right now, before we get into the meat of the show, spring has sprung, like you said, and we're going to start, the forecast is going to start warming up. And if you have apple trees and stuff, you know, once those low time, nighttime temperatures get above 40, you know, start thinking about maybe spraying your trees if you have any with horticultural oil.
Okay.
You know, if you have any insect issues in the past. So this is the time.
Yep, and so. Pruning is over with. I had a phone call today asking if they can still prune. And I mean, maybe you can get away with it at some elevations, depending on what your trees are doing. But okay. I've seen some trees around that I don't think should be pruned anymore.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they're in silver tip now, you know, so I don't know. It'd be all right most places. But, yeah, down I wouldn't go pruning in Accord or Olive Bridge where I live or Central Ulster County. But if you're in Bovina, you probably get away with it.
Yep.
You know, if you're up there on, you know, Claryville, you're probably golden.
Oh, you've
just another month of March.
Another 2 weeks, right?
Yeah, sure. But, well, speaking of Claryville, just down the hill in Grahamsville, we have our host who's coming on, or our guest who's coming on tonight. And tonight's topic is going to be floodplains and forests with resource educator Brent Ghosh. And let me see if I can get him on. Hey, Brent, you there?
I am. How are you, Ryan?
I'm well. So how are things with you?
Doing just fine. We're, you know, in our lockdown, I suppose, and working from home like many folks are these days. But we're doing just swell. Thanks for asking. Now, hope you guys are good, too.
Yeah, we're doing okay. We're over here in Roxbury, Delaware County, but the radio station is still operating, so that's good. And, Brent, so you're with the Ulster County Cornell Cooperative Extension?
That is correct, sir. I've been there. It's coming on almost 9 years now. I think my anniversary will be in June, so just about 9 years with Ulster County Extension.
Okay, and you specialize in flood hazard mitigation and a certified floodplain manager. How'd you do that?
So yeah, that's right. That's my specialty here with the association with Extension. So the way I became a certified floodplain manager, CFM for short, that is a national certification that the way you get it is you have to take an examination. You know, it's roughly a three-hour examination, and they test you – multiple choice mostly – and they test you on a whole host of topics related to the topic of flood hazard mitigation. So questions about flood insurance rate maps and flood insurance studies and how to read maps with the – you know, how to determine base flood elevations and, you know, it's a whole bunch of different topics. And if you get a passing score, then you get the honor of becoming a certified floodplain manager, which I am.
So just tell us a little bit about yourself, Brent. Like, where are you from and stuff, and what got you into watershed education?
Sure. So I'm from Grahamsville, New York, so that's in northern Sullivan County in the town of Neversink, probably just about as far south as you could go and still be considered the Catskills, at least the Catskills proper. And I've lived there pretty much my whole life. And the thing that got me into this realm of work is, well, there's a couple things. I always like to tell folks the story. You know, number one, I don't think there's very many little boys out there who grew up to say, yes, I want to be a floodplain administrator when I grow up, right? That's usually it's astronaut, usually it's rock star, that sort of thing. Very few people say I want to be a floodplain administrator. But I'll say this. When I was a kid, I was very young, I don't remember how old I was, I remember watching TV and there was a commercial on, and it was a commercial of a guy reading a newspaper sitting in his easy chair in the living room, and there was water that started rising from the floor all the way up until eventually got over his head, and he was just sitting there kind of oblivious to it. And I remember saying to myself, like, oh, this is a really silly commercial. I don't really understand this. And at the time, I was young. I didn't really get it. But what it was a commercial from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and they actually put, you know, very similar commercials out to this day, trying to encourage people to get flood insurance, because flood insurance really is the only type of funding, or if you will, available to private individuals if your home gets damaged by a flood. So that's something that always stuck with me. And again, I didn't go to school necessarily because, like, oh, I necessarily want to be a floodplain manager. But that always kind of stuck with me there, and it's just kind of ironic that I'm in that line of work now. But the reason I got onto it is, you know, I grew up on, you know, a farm here in town of Neversink. You know, forestry was always, you know, something that was important to my family. My father was a forester with DEC. And just being very interested in the environment and environmental conservation. And so I kind of fell into this job in a way, but I was very lucky to be involved in an organization that has environmental conservation at the forefront of its mission.
So the year before you became a certified floodplain manager was a big year in the Catskills, wasn't it, for flooding?
It was indeed. So 2011, as many folks remember, was the year that Hurricane, well, actually technically it was a tropical storm by the time it got to us, but the year Hurricane Irene actually hit our area. And Hurricane Irene was the flood of record for just about everywhere in the Catskills. And it was a little bit of a different storm depending upon where you went. Different, you know, localities in the Catskills got hit a little bit differently. A lot of places, so where I work in Ulster County, so that's predominantly, you know, Phoenicia area, Boyceville, you know, Town Olive, Shandaken area. That was still the flood of record. That was the biggest storm that we've ever seen in as long as we've been keeping, you know, stream gauge records. So we have roughly, maybe not quite 100 years of stream gauge records. So that was definitely the biggest storm, but it was not quite the 100-year storm. It was really, in that area, I would say it was roughly like maybe the 90-year storm. So it was close, but it wasn't, you know, the quote-unquote big one. But if you go a little bit north to Prattsville, that was legitimately over the 500-year flood. And in matter of fact, it was probably somewhere between the 500 and 1,000-year flood. And the only reason they don't really know exactly what it was is because the stream gauge got knocked off online. It was damaged from the flooding. So it was a massive storm all over the Catskills, but particularly in, you know, some of those northern spots in Delaware and Greene County.
Do you remember how many inches of rain fell in a 24-hour period or whatever? I don't remember. It was a lot.
I don't remember, but it was massive. I don't want to speculate. I don't want to give your listeners bad information, so I don't really remember, but it was a tremendous amount of water. And the thing about that year, if you recall, was that was a very, very wet summer. So we had a lot of rain that summer. So the ground was already waterlogged. The water tables were very high. And just, you know, that massive amount of water that came down, that just put us over the edge, if you will. There was nowhere for it to infiltrate. It ran right off the landscape and went right into our rivers and streams, and that contributed greatly to the extent of flooding.
So what do you mean when you say the 100-year flood and the 1,000-year flood? I mean, those are things you just said we don't keep record, or we haven't kept record for nearly anything over the last 100 years. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, no, that's actually a great question, and that's something when I do my educational programs with different groups, it's something I always try to bring up. So the 100-year flood or the 500-year flood, or, you know, you can even have a 25-year flood. It's just a matter of talking about data and statistics. A lot of people incorrectly think that, oh, you know, when you have a 100-year storm, that means that you're only going to get that type of storm once every 100 years. So, for example, here in the town of Neversink, the last – what you could probably call a legitimate 100-year storm that we experienced occurred in roughly, I think it was the year 1928. My grandfather is no longer with us, but he was a little boy. He experienced that, and he remembers that, and he used to talk about it. So when I talk to some of the old-timers around here where I live, they all say, oh, we don't have to worry about the 100-year storm. You know, the last one that happened here by us was in 1928, so we don't have to worry about that until 2028. Well, number one, 2028 isn't really that far away anymore, so that doesn't give you much assurance. But the reality is the 100-year storm, that designation, is a little bit of a misnomer. What the 100-year storm really means is that you have a 1% chance out of 100 of that, you know, magnitude of storm occurring in any given year. We use the term 100-year storm or 500-year storm or whatever the interval you want is, because it's an easy thing to say. It's something that kind of flows off the tongue a little bit easier. It's part of our, you know, normal lexicon, if you will. Using the term 1% annual chance flood, that's not something that, you know, people kind of, you know, latch on to as easy as the 100-year storm. But really what it boils down to, it's just a way of talking about statistics, right? So a 100-year storm has a 1% chance of occurring in any given year. It could happen once every 50 years, once every 25 years. It could happen, you know, year after year in a row. It could happen multiple times in a given year. Again, it's just a way of talking about statistics. And, you know, a 500-year storm has a 0.2% chance. It's just a lower return interval. And, you know, again, we don't see 500-year storms all that often. But, again, you know, the village of Prattsville, they legitimately experienced a 500-year storm. So they're not unheard of in our area.
Well, thanks for clearing that up, because I did not know that. So I'm going to start saying 1% annual for a 100-year flood, right? Is that right?
That is exactly right, and please do that. That will get the word out much, much better than whatever I can do.
All right, how about that? So clear another thing up for us, Brent. When you're going on 28, say you're going west from Kingston, and you pass by Shokan, or Shokan, however you say it, you see your office. So it's the Shokan Watershed Stream Management Program. How does that relate to Cornell Cooperative Extension and the DEP and all that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the Ashokan Watershed Stream Management Program is it's really an umbrella term. It's not an independent entity. Like, we don't have, you know, financial papers or anything like that. It's just a name for a partnership that exists between three agencies. The first agency is Cornell Cooperative Extension of Ulster County. That's my direct employer. Our job is to do a lot of the education and outreach for the organization. So we're the ones that go to, say, like the Ulster County Fair, you know, Shandaken Day, Olive Day, a lot of the different community groups. We have, you know, again, independent programming we do for a lot of the municipalities in the area, work with landowners. So we kind of do, I like to say, kind of the touchy-feely part of it, you know, the going around and talking with people and meeting with folks and doing the education. Now, the second agency involved with the organization is the Ulster County Soil and Water Conservation District, and they're the technical arm of the program. So what they do is they'll go out well, they do many things, but they're one of their primary things they do is they'll go out during field season, so, you know, late spring, summer, into the fall, and they'll go into the streams and they'll actually do stream assessments. And that's some really cool stuff of what they do. They actually get into the stream and they'll walk the length of the stream. And, you know, we go to different ones each year and they'll collect data at certain points. You know, they'll GPS locations where there's erosion occurring, where there's aggradation, that's the building up of the stream bed with gravel and cobble and sediment, or degradation, you know, the opposite of that, the downcutting of the stream. They'll flag those, electronically. They'll also do cross sections where they'll, you know, set up a cross section and run across the stream to determine channel dimensions. They'll do longitudinal profiles, which is kind of the same idea, but instead of going across the stream, you're going up and down the stream. And then what they do is they collect all that data, and at the end of the season, usually, you know, this time of year, winter, you know, early spring, they'll create what are known as stream management plans. Well, they'll put all that data into a reference document, and they'll provide recommendations that we'll give to you know, that you can use it as an individual homeowner, but it's more geared for municipalities, highway departments, those sorts of, agency level stakeholders. And they'll give recommendations what we can do to best manage the stream. And then the final agency that's involved with the program is the New York City Department of Environmental Protection. They provide technical services for us, but they're also our primary watch. They're our main funder for the organization. So the whole reason we're in existence is because we're located in the New York City watershed that provides water supply and drinking water for something like upwards of 9 million New York City and residents and a few others along the Hudson Valley corridor there. And, you know, one of their goals is to manage the drinking water, so all the water that flows into the reservoir, and try to keep that as clean and as pristine as possible. And they have many, many different programs to accomplish that goal. One of their programs is the stream management program. And so their thought process is that if we can make sure that our streams are managed properly, as long as they're healthy, as long as the water in it is clean and healthy, then there's less less money that they have to expend on their end. So down in the city near the treatment plants, the treatment plants there to keep it, you know, they have to spend less money at the treatment plants to keep the water clean. So those are the three agencies that make up the Ashokan Watershed Stream Management Program. I'll also mention briefly that, you know, our jurisdiction is Ulster County, but Green, Delaware, and Sullivan also have sister programs that are set up very, very similar to the way we are, doing the same type of work.
Okay, yeah, because what is it, the Rondout Neversink? What's that called again?
Yep, that's correct. The Rondout Neversink Stream Program down in Grahamsville, they do, again, pretty much the exact same work that we do.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is floodplains and forests with resource educator Brent Ghosh. Brent, how do you say your last name exactly before I mess it up?
No, you got it just right. Okay. Ghosh is correct.
All right, nice.
Most people say Gotch or something odd like that, but nope, it's my whole life I've been told it's pronounced Ghosh, and apparently that's what, you know, great-great-grandpa who came over from Germany used to say, so they pronounce it Ghosh, so we're sticking with it.
All right. All right, good to know. So about the Ashokan watershed, you know, give us a little context. You know, what is the land use history a little bit? Any notable geology? Anything that separates it from other watersheds or makes it kind of noteworthy?
Yeah, sure. So the land use history of the Ashokan watershed, as most places in the Catskills, it was, you know, forested during the time of, you know, during prehistoric times, during the time of the Native Americans. It was mostly a forested landscape. There's many other people out there that probably could tell that history better than I could. But, of course, as we know, I'm sure you guys know too, Native Americans populated the area. I know they did some limited burnings there for different reasons. But it wasn't until European settlers came, and originally it was the Dutch. And although I was told actually the Dutch really didn't get out of the main Hudson Valley corridor, so like New Paltz, Kingston, they kind of congregated there. They didn't really go up to like the Shandakens and the Pine Hills of the world at that point in time. It really was when the English took over that they actually really started pushing west. But when those settlers pushed west, they cleared the forest, for farming, for sheep actually. I believe sheep raising was a big part of the landscape in the 18th, 19th century. But one of the big things that occurred all over the Catskills, not just in the Ashokan watershed, was the tanneries, right? So the tanneries, some of the acid factories, and what they would do is they would cut the hemlocks, take the tannin from the bark of the hemlocks, and they would use that to tan leather products. And so that was a really big industry back again in the 19th century, 1800 era time period. And of course, in a way, we're kind of living with the legacy of that. There was a lot of deforestation, which contributed to excess of sediment going into our stream. And so we're kind of living a little bit with that legacy of land use. I'm not a geologist by training, and this is probably one of the weaker areas that I'm in. There's many of that. I get made fun of a lot at work. Most of my colleagues are geologists by training, so I'm like the one person who's not a geology nerd. But the one thing I can tell you about the Ashokan watershed, and this is mostly true of the other watersheds in Delaware and Greene and Sullivan County, but particularly in the Ashokan watershed, we have a lot of lacustrine or glacial clay. That's what our soil is made up of. So if you go along almost any stream bank and dig down deep enough, you're going to hit a layer of clay, and that's a result of the glaciers, millions of years ago coming through the area, carving out the landscape, melting, and creating these, large lakes of glacial water. The water would sit there and the geology would do its thing, right? And it would create these clay seams. And what's happened is over time, and some of this is natural, but a lot of it's a result of human intervention. What happened is, during, not so much the colonial era, but like the 1800s, 19, or even up into the 20th century, what we would do is if there was flooding, one of the things that we would do as a management strategy historically, which was dredge the stream. The idea is if you dig as deep as you can and as wide as you can in a stream, that creates more capacity for the water to go, so you're not going to have flooding. I mean, that makes sense on a certain intuitive level, but that's really unfortunately not how it works. And so what happens is the streams have meander bends. As they come off the mountainside, the physics of the water creates these sort of S-shaped patterns in the streams. And as a result of that, and the river wants to be that way, but when human beings mess with it, we tend to cut off those meander patterns. We make them, nice and long and straight. And the river wants to have that serpentine pattern to it. And as a result, it's going to cut into its stream banks. It's going to dig down into the soil, into its stream bed. And those glacial clay seams are becoming exposed. And what happens is when the water rushes across those glacial clay seams, it picks up, sediment, clay particles. And that's when you look at the river during a heavy rainstorm. And we see it being, this really muddy brown color. We sometimes say, oh, it looks like Yoo-hoo, right? It looks like this really chocolatey, soupy mess. And besides being unsightly, the problem with that is it can harbor those little clay particles can harbor viruses and bacteria on it and other, germy things that can make people sick if they consume it. So New York City is very interested in trying to prevent these clay particles, this turbidity from entering into the system. And that's kind of the legacy of the glacial, the glacial processes and the land use processes of the watershed, trying to deal with that, that legacy of human and natural intervention in the landscape.
John?
That's all very interesting. I've taken stream ecology courses, but it's been a long time since I've thought about a stream.
Brent, if areas of focus, so let's talk about water quality. I mean, what does that mean when someone says, when someone's assessing, what's the criteria for water quality?
Yeah, so I think it really depends on what your goals are. So if you, let's say, for example, that you want it as a drinking water supply. Now, this could be, you're building a house and you want to sink a well, or you could be a big municipality like New York City and need to supply, clean, potable drinking water to, 9 million residents. So that's a certain level of quality that you want to have. So if you were to go home and fill up, a vial of water, from your tap, you could send it to, any number of labs across the state or across the country, and they would would analyze the water to see what sort of, you know, what's going on in it. They could say, well, you know, we're finding, you know, E. coli, which is a bad thing to have in your water, if you wanted to know that. Or it could say, you know, you have certain, you know, metals and certain, you know, chemicals in the water. And not all those things are bad. And if you have a little bit, you know, it's probably not going to hurt you. But you want to have a very high threshold of purity to the water if you want to use it as a drinking water supply. So, you know, again, that's, you have to manage, you know, your water a different way if you want to have it for drinking. Now, if you want to have it as a trout stream, that doesn't mean it can be just, you know, dirty and polluted. But, you know, if there's certain, you know, if there's a higher level of dirt or turbidity in the water, you know, there's a certain threshold that fish could, you know, can survive in it. Matter of fact, a lot of the trout species and fish species that are native to the Esopus, which is the main stream in the Ashokan, actually have evolved. The fishery scientists have told us this, that they've evolved to deal with the turbidity. Because turbidity is, you know, even though I've said previously that human beings kind of set off this turbidity, and that is true, it's also a natural process as well. So the fish, you know, are equipped to deal with certain levels of turbidity. So, you know, you can have a certain muddier, dirtier stream, you know, less, you know, it doesn't have to be drinking water quality if you're worried about, you know, fish and other wildlife habitat. If you want to have it just for swimming or bathing, that's a whole other set of criteria. So it really depends upon what the goals are for the particular location. Again, sort of a higher level of criteria if you're listening for drinking water, if a lower level of criteria if you're using it for other resources. I know the pH, usually you want to have it a pretty neutral pH, so, you know, roughly like 7 pH, and I forget what somebody, I'd have to look it up, but there's several different, you know, elements in the water that you should have, you know, lower and higher amounts if you want to have it as an indicator of good quality drinking water.
Yeah, that's when I go fishing, is when it's turbid.
Well, you know, you talk to any of the guys from Trout Unlimited or people who are just anglers, and, you know, everybody wants to go out in the stream when it's a, you know, nice clear stream, and that probably is when the best fishing occurs. But, you know, I know plenty of fishermen who go out during, you know, those when it's running dirty, and they still catch fish. It's all about the skill and the patience, I think, about whether you want to catch fish or not.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure about the Esopus, but some smaller streams, when they're a little turbid, I think it's just because the trout can't see you walking up to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I catch more. I have more success. Yeah, but I only fish one way, so that's what works for me. I don't, you know, mm-hmm. But, yeah, I don't know. What do you think, John?
Yeah, if you're throwing a spinner out there, I think you're right. I mean, walking up to the edge of a pool.
Yeah, for spinner maybe. I don't know what flies. You know,
yeah. Just flies are just harder to float on a turbid stream that's elevated and running fast.
Makes sense. So floodplain management. What causes floods? Obviously, a lot of water. But I guess, you know, when you think in your head, Brent, you know, of a healthy stream that's going to mitigate floods, what do you think about?
Yeah. So there's a couple of points here I actually want to bring up. I'm glad you asked the question. So flooding is a completely natural process. Human beings tend to think of flooding as this, you know, horrible thing, and I understand why. You know, every time we hear about a flood, it's because, you know, somebody's home got wiped out, or a town got wiped out, or a bridge got blown out, and you know, at the very least, it's inconvenient, and at the worst end of it, people may have lost their lives. So it can be a traumatic experience for folks. But flooding is a completely natural thing. You know, rivers are meant to flood. If you, you know, take a stream, you know, ecology or a stream dynamics course, what you'll learn is that, you know, for the stream to maintain a healthy equilibrium with the rest of its landscape, right? So a stream to be healthy needs to have a roughly equal amount of water versus sediment supply going through the stream. And floods are just a typical, you know, thing that happens naturally, periodically, every few years. You know, you're going to get a flood. Now, you might not get a 100-year flood every few years, but you might get a small flood. You know, you may have heard the term bankful before. Bankful is we use that term a lot in our line of work. That's where the river just barely starts to flood. It's basically at capacity, right? And that's the point in time where the river actually starts to change its meander patterns. It might grade, degrade, you know, move, shift across its floodplain, across its valley a little bit. So flooding is only bad if our stuff is in the way of it, right? That's the one key point I'd like your listeners to take away from this. You know, flooding in itself is not a bad thing. It's actually something that's needed for the stream to be healthy, to remain stable. It's only a bad thing if we have our infrastructure, our homes, our businesses, our roads, you know, what have you, in the way of it. So we really shouldn't be working to make the stream not flood. we should be working to find ways to protect the assets that we have from flooding. I mean, that's the key takeaway that I want listeners to take away from this talk here.
What's your thoughts on coarse woody debris? I mean, when I took watershed hydrology in college, they were all about coarse woody debris in the streams, but the professor alluded to that 20 years before that, or 30 or whatever, it was shunned against. You wouldn't put anything in there. It was basically like a pipe. Like you said before, you dig it deeper to fill more capacity. And now, you know, you fast forward to present day, and people are talking about coarse woody debris in there to create better stream habitat. Is that true? How do you feel about that?
So that's actually a huge topic of conversation that we have all the time. And the term we actually use is, well, so it's kind of complicated. The historical term for wood in the stream, at least the one that I've used since I've worked here, is called large woody debris. I believe coarse woody debris is land-based downed wood, if I'm saying this correctly. And large woody debris is in the stream. It's semantics, but be that as it may, that's what we've always called it. Right. And we're actually moving away from that term. It's almost, I like to joke, it's kind of like a politically correct stream management term now. We like to call it just large wood in the stream. Debris has a negative connotation, although I would caution against, you know, just Googling large wood on your computer. You might come up with something you don't want to see. But anyway, you're exactly right. So historically, and, you know, you go back in the historical record, they'll talk about, you know, wood, and you'll talk about tree snags, you know, in rivers and in streams. And you got to remember that streams and rivers back in, you know, historically were used for not just, you know, access to water for cattle or, you know, livestock and agriculture, but they were also used for transportation. So if you had logs in the stream or down trees or even branches that impeded that transportation, that was a big deal, right? So you had to get that out of there to move, you know, to float your boats and to get up and down the stream. So that's kind of where that idea of, you know, getting the wood out of the stream came from, right? But what we found now with some of the newer research is that in some streams, the only way that stream is maintaining stability is having that large wood in the stream, right? It creates grade control. It's an area where the water will hit, it'll slow down. And when the water slows down, it loses velocity. The slower the velocities of the water, the less material that's, you know, digging up and bringing with it. So it actually slows the process down and helps to keep erosion at bay. So there's two very different schools of thought. And again, you talk to 10 people about, you know, large wooden streams, you're going to get 10 different opinions, right? But there's a school of thought that, just like you said, some people, it's kind of the more traditional view, you know, if there's wood in the stream, we got to get it out. It's a hazard. And sadly, you hear about this, you know, people who are swimming or kayaking or tubing is a big thing on the Esopus, getting caught up in the wood and drowning, right? And that's a tragedy. Nobody wants to have that happen. But then you talk to, you know, some of the ecologists, and they'll say, you know, those wood snags are perfect habitat for fish and other aquatic organisms. They provide refuge from predators. They provide, you know, some shade from the sun to keep the water temperatures lower. A lot of the aquatic animals and insects and stuff that we have, you know, require colder temperatures. So they're important for that. And you talk to some of the geomorphologists out there, some of the scientists who study how rivers, you know, change their shape and their pattern. And they're going to tell you the same thing. They're going to say, you know, we need the large wood in stream along the stream banks, to keep that grade control, to keep, you know, the water from eroding into the side of the stream bank. I'll just give one brief example. So you may recall several years ago, there was a tragic situation where, a teenage girl drowned on the Esopus. She wasn't tubing, but she was in the stream with her father, and she got swept away by a current and sadly drowned in a woody debris jam. And, you know, of course, there was a big uproar in the community, and I believe it was actually the National Guard came in, you know, a few weeks later, and they removed that wood jam, right? And so, okay, yes, you got rid of that problem, but then our technicians from the Soil and Water District went out there, and they monitored that site, right? And over the span of – it was very short. It was less than a month. We lost six – it was – I forget, it was either 6 or 10 feet of stream bank. The water was cutting so deeply into the stream bank, it actually may have posed a threat to the road, which is Route 28 right near there, if they allowed it to continue. Now, it did stabilize over time, but that just shows you how important that wood is, not just for habitat, but also grade control, and it's a vital element of stream process. So you really need to be careful with how you manage large wood. There's a professor, and I forget her name. I feel really bad right now because she's a brilliant lady and a really good speaker. But she's with the University of Colorado, and she created a protocol that we actually use now with the municipalities, where if there is a large woody debris jam somewhere on the stream, you know, ourselves and community stakeholders will go out. And, you know, there's basically a kind of like a flow chart, if you will. You'll walk through it, and if it scores a certain way, then you leave the wood in place. If it scores another way, maybe you cut a piece of it, or maybe you move it to a different location. And if it has another score, then you remove it completely. And it all depends upon the different elements of, you know, what are you managing the stream for? What are the hazards for human beings? What are the environmental implications? You know, all these, this multidisciplinary approach is what goes into managing large woods. So it's a very complicated and a very controversial topic, and it's something that comes up a lot, not only in our office, you know, internally, but also with our stakeholders out in the community.
So I understand, as a trout fisherman, you know, a large wood in the stream, I can see how it slows it down kind of like a sponge and creates great pools and riffles and great habitat. I think where the public or people get confused is, I remember when I was at the SUNY ESF, Environmental Science and Forestry, there was one professor that stated the Army Corps of Engineers is the most successful agency because they got paid to put in all these dams, and then they got paid to remove them.
yes, very true.
Right. So in the public's mindset, it's very confusing. Because 1950s were impounding, were like, if you go through Rosendale, or if you go through Ellenville, they took the beer kill there, and basically impounded it and put it through a pipe. Did the same thing in Rosendale, and it definitely mitigated floods. I would say. I mean, they're not getting floods going through Rosendale anymore. I think the most recent one was in the 1980s. I'm not sure exactly, but in any case, so is there a time to do that, or is that now just blacklisted? How do you go about where streams go through municipalities where we're not getting rid of houses or bridges and stuff like that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So one of the things I always like, and you're right, it's a concern. People, you know, look, there are certain places where we can, I like to say, relocate structures, right? Move them to a safer location away from the river, give the river a chance to move and to flood its floodplain. In those areas, you know, we should be thinking about doing it and using zoning and you know, land acquisition to accomplish those tasks. But you're absolutely right. There are certain places, heavily urbanized areas, where you're not going to be able to get that. The one thing I guess I could point out is that, you know, I like to use the example of the Los Angeles River, the famous LA River, that if you go to LA, you know, where the LA River runs through, you know, the city of Los Angeles, it's very famous in the sense because basically it's just a concrete chute, right? There's no, you know, soil, there's no plant material. It's just this giant concrete chute of water, you know, that they just have to move the water from point A to point B through the city as quickly as possible. And the reason they did that was for all the reasons you just stated before. They wanted to try to attenuate the flooding risk. And what they're doing in LA, and it's not just LA, it's cities all over the country, all over the world now, they're breaking up that concrete. They're, you know, allowing the river to become a more natural river by putting sediment in. They're actually planting native riparian plants, everything from grasses and shrubs to trees even. And what they're finding is that when you return the river to that more natural state and giving it even just the smallest amount of space to flood, you know, to meander back and forth across the valley, you're actually reducing the flood risk. And the reason for that is because when you're sending the water down a concrete, you know, sluiceway, like you would with the LA River, or, you know, those sections in Ellenville and other places that you mentioned, you're creating a lot of velocity because there's no roughness in the water. The water's just flowing through there as quickly as possible. And if it jumps those banks, and it does from time to time, then you know, the people on the overland bank side, you know, they're in a world of hurt, right? And there's maintenance, of course, associated with keeping that infrastructure up. You have to, you know, it's not a one and done thing. You can't just, you know, lay concrete and call it a day. You have to go back there periodically to, you know, to fix it and, you know, to put new down. But if you allow the river a chance to be a little bit more natural, it actually, again, this is the idea of working with the river as opposed to against it. You allow the natural processes to take effect. You allow the water to slow down a little bit so you have less erosive potential. A little bit, and if you give it just a little bit of space to flood, It's going to reduce those flood levels. Again, even just a tiny little bit can make all the difference. And it's really just going to be beneficial in the long run, environmentally, for infrastructure. It's just really going to be the best for most people. Again, I'm sure there are certain situations, like you said, Rosendale is an example, probably certain places in Ellenville, other locations where that can't happen, and you just have to have that infrastructure in place. And if that's the case, then, you know, you just keep maintaining the infrastructure and doing what you got to do. But in many examples, in many, many cases across, you know, again, the region, across the country, if you can give that river a chance to be in a little bit more natural state, it's just going to pay dividends for you way down the road.
So what you're saying is, correct me if I'm wrong, you're basically passing the buck downstream.
Very much so, yep.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, I could see that as a private property rights issue. You know, if they're doing that and they're making matters worse, I could see downstream people, you know, having a case. You know, I mean, if they're increasing the velocity, that can't be good.
No, absolutely. And I'm sure there's been, you know, lawsuits and community fights when, you know, different, you know, areas have put in levees and put in flood walls to try to, you know, keep floodwaters in the stream channel. And, you know, because like you said, the water doesn't just go away magically, right? So when you compress that floodplain, right, the water would normally a river or stream, when it floods, the water would spread out across the floodplain. And, you know, when you give it a chance to spread out, the levels go lower, right? So if you have I'm just making this number up, but if you have like a mile wide floodplain, you might only have an inch or half an inch or a quarter of an inch of water across that whole floodplain. That's something that's manageable. But if you throw a flood wall or a levee right up along the stream bank, now you might have 10, 20 feet of water coursing down that stream channel, and eventually that, you know, you can't practically put a levee down an entire stretch of river. I mean, that would be impossible to do financially speaking. So eventually it's going to get to the end of that. And when it gets to the end of that, it's going to flood whatever's there. And you know what? Maybe if it's open space and there's nobody around, maybe it's not a big deal. But if it's in a more populated area, or if it's, like you said, a private property owner there, then that could very well be a problem.
Or it's New Orleans, but I digress.
Well, they're the poster child of what happens when you, well, they're a poster child of a lot of things, but you know, when you have the intersection of massive hurricanes, climate change, and improperly maintained levees and dense population, you get a New Orleans with Hurricane Katrina, which nobody ever wants to repeat.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is floodplains and forests with resource educator Brent Goetsch. We're going to take a break, but up next, we got to get into the forest and where they intersect with floodplains. The show is flying by.
Too big for his bed. Nothing seems to fit. Those raindrops are falling on my head. They keep falling. So I just did me some talking to the sun. And I said I didn't like the way he got things done. Sleeping on the job. Those raindrops are falling. Soon be turning red. Crying's not for me, 'cause I'm never gonna stop the rain by complaining, because I'm free. Nothing's worrying me. Steps up to greet me. Raindrops keep falling on my head, but that doesn't mean my eyes will soon be turning red. Crying's not for me, 'cause I'm never gonna stop the rain by complaining,
as I'm free. Nothing's worrying me.
You hear that, John? You're never going to stop the rain by complaining.
What happened to trumpets and pop music?
Trumpets and pop? I don't know. We should bring it back, though, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know?
Keyboards and trumpets.
How many times do you hear people complaining about the rain, like as if they're going to stop it?
Yeah.
Always. Anyway, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is floodplains and forests with resource educator Brent Goach. So, Brent, let's talk about forests. Oh, actually, John's got a question.
Yeah, so we talked about large woody trees in the stream. Is there ever a time to add them to the stream? Are people doing this? Is this frowned upon? And then if it is being done, what's the methods behind it and who's doing it and why and how?
Man.
No, it's a great – oh, sorry.
A lot of questions.
Sorry, I was going to jump in here. I'll finish your question. I'm sorry.
No, that was all of it. That was all of it.
Yeah, so that's a great question, and that's something that is actually happening. There are places in the country where they are actually adding wood into the stream. You're seeing this, to my knowledge, mostly in the Pacific Northwest, and the reason for that is because of the salmon runs. And apparently having that large wood in the stream is beneficial for salmon habitat, and as they're making their way up the stream to spawn, you know, I think it's, you know, places of refuge for them to go, so they're not always fighting against the current. And of course, the salmon fishery is a big deal up in, you know, that part of the country. So they're definitely adding wood into the stream in, you know, the Washington states, the Oregons, Northern California areas of the country, you know, where those salmon runs are. To a lesser degree, we are actually doing it locally too. So one of the things that we do when we're designing, stream management, stream restoration projects, one of the things that we occasionally do, if, you know, the conditions are right on in that particular stretch of the stream, is we'll take down trees, usually on site. You know, we generally don't truck them in, but there's a tree on site that we have to remove because, you know, we're expanding the floodplain or, you know, cutting the bank in a certain place. We'll cut the tree. We'll bury part of the tree, usually the crown part of it, in the stream bank, right? We'll cable it in, make sure that it's not going to move anywhere. And we'll leave the root ball actually jutting out into the stream itself against the flow of water. And that serves a couple purposes. One purpose to that is to actually act as roughness into the stream. Again, that's slowing down the stream, the velocity of the water coming, you know, down the stream, which helps prevent erosion. And it's also creating habitat, right? That's, again, places of refuge for fish and other wildlife. There's some ecological as well as practical implications for putting wood in the stream.
Is there ever a time that someone's just felling a tree into the stream? Is that ever appropriate? Or looking for heavy machinery like you're talking?
Yeah, so, certainly if you're going to put heavy machinery in the stream, you need a stream permit for that. If you're just getting your chainsaw and cutting a tree, I mean, here's the deal. Like, it's a large, or actually, let me back up. If it's a small stream that's, you know, just on your property, only your property, and you want to throw wood in the stream, cut a tree across it, you know, I don't think that's a particular problem there. I mean, the water's going to either go under or around it in some capacity, right? You're probably not going to be creating a hazard. I mean, and of course, as we know here in the Catskill Park, you know, in the Catskill Mountain area, you know, trees fall down all the time, right? And they're going to be falling across streams. So again, it's a natural process. And if you help it along with your chainsaw, that's usually not a big deal. The caveat to that is if you're in a larger, more, I hate to use the term, a more navigable stream, I don't really consider the Esopus navigable, but technically it is, like a stream like the Esopus, right? One where there's a lot of activity, a lot of, you know, kayakers, tubers, fishermen, that sort of thing, where there's a lot of landowners, purposely putting a tree across the stream could lead to a hazard. And if it's proven that you purposely put the tree there, you know, even if it's on your private property, because the Esopus is technically a navigable stream, if somebody is kayaking down the stream and, you know, hits that log, potentially you could be liable for that. So I would say, again, if it's a small stream, you own both banks, nothing really around you, probably not a problem. If it's a larger stream where there's a lot of different landowners around you, when it's heavily trafficked, I would shy away from it for legal implications at the very least.
Brent, we got about 7 minutes left. I wanted to ask you a little bit about land use, forest management particularly. What's the ideal land use? I mean, is there one? And if so, and then get into forest management.
Yeah, sure. And that's, you know, there's an intersection here, right? So I know you guys with Catskill Forest Association, you know, your level of focus is on the more upland areas, right? The areas where it's, you know, kind of high and dry for the most part. Not, you know, not the aquatic or riparian area where we're focused, you know, the aquatic being kind of the more submerged environment, the riparian areas, that, you know, transition area between, you know, the stream and the more upland areas. And really the management strategies, I think, are very, very similar, right? A healthy floodplain, a healthy stream bank is going to be vegetated in some capacity. Now, that could mean different sedges. So these are, you know, grasses that grow along the stream. It could be things like shrubs, like dogwood is one, more of a shrubby type plant. Different willows, you know, so like pussy willow, heart-shaped willow. There's a couple other ones I'm forgetting. You know, those types of more, I mean, I guess technically they might, you correct me if I'm wrong, I guess technically they're trees, but they're really more shrubs, right? You know, that's important for the riparian habitat. But there's also several different types of tree species. Sycamore is a very important riparian tree species. Hemlock is another one. As we know, they're fortunately they're under threat from the hemlock woolly adelgid. And we're actually, there's a lot of talk in my program and elsewhere about, you know, what are the management implications for when all the hemlocks die from the adelgid, right?
Yeah.
But the intersection here is that when you have those well-vegetated floodplains, and, you know, it transitions a little bit into the upland area, you know, those roots from all those different plants are going to grow really deep into the ground. They're going to intersect with one another. They're going to hold that soil in place. So that's going to help prevent erosion. It's going to help dissipate the flow of water. So when the water comes up over the stream bank and hits all that vegetation, it's, again, it's going to slow down. It's going to allow the water to infiltrate into the floodplain areas, help recharge that groundwater, help recharge those wetlands, all that really important habitat. I guess what I would say is where it comes into play with forest management is that the one thing we want to try to do is keep riparian buffers as vegetated as possible. So again, that's not to say you can never, ever, ever cut a tree in a riparian area. I would never tell you not to do that. But we want to try to keep it as heavily vegetated as possible. And that's for, I think, most people's benefit, right? It keeps the water levels flowing smoother, right? It allows for the infiltration to happen, as we mentioned. It provides really good habitat. In an ideal world, we'd like to see people give the stream a 100-foot buffer. So from the stream bank, 100 feet back, we want to give the river that much space to have as its floodplain. So keep that vegetated, keep that forested. And, you know, the more upland areas, if you have a good, you know, sustainable, properly done forest management plan, forest management strategy, there's nothing inherently wrong with doing timber harvesting or anything like that outside of that riparian buffer. Now, again, there's leeway to cut into that a little bit more. Certainly if there's a tree that's dying or is a hazardous tree, by all means, you know, have it cut. If you want to, you know, plant certain plants or different trees for you know, wildlife or what have you, that's perfectly acceptable too. The real key, though, is to have that vegetarian riparian buffer. It's good for the environment. It's good for your property. So you're not going to, you know, if you keep that vegetated, you're not going to lose upland property, right? So, you know, it's important to at least give the stream that buffer for itself and to keep that vegetation relatively undisturbed.
So, Brent, as you know, I live in central Ulster County in the town of Olive, and I go by on 28A through West Shokan around the Oshokan Reservoir. And I notice there's hardly anything grown, due mostly to deer probably. Mm-hmm. Is this an issue, the lack of regeneration, having only – maybe it's not. Maybe ferns are just fine or some barberry. But how much is this on your radar, if at all?
No, it absolutely is. And so one of my colleagues, he's in charge of doing, it's called the Catskill Streams Buffer Initiative. It's basically the department within our program that deals with the riparian buffers and you know, planting them. And yeah, deer is a huge issue. Deer don't just eat saplings. They eat basically anything that grows, right? So all the stuff that we plant for riparian buffers, the maybe not so much the willows, they tend to leave those alone, but the sedges, different grasses, a lot of the other shrubby type plants, they like them just as much as, you know, oak and maple seedlings, right? So that's a big problem for us. And we've had to use tree tubes and try to fence areas in to keep the deer out. And, you know, for the same reason that you guys are concerned about forest regeneration and not having that, you know, that new store, you know, that forest regeneration come up from, you know, from the forest floor there, you know, we're concerned about the riparian buffers, right? As I mentioned earlier, if we don't have that vegetated buffer, then you're going to, again, environmentally it's a problem, but also you have potential for, you know, infrastructure and buildings to be at risk. So it's a challenge for us too. We want to see healthy natural regeneration from the different types of trees and plants that we use in our buffers, just as much as, you know, you guys or anybody else would be concerned about forest regeneration in the more upland areas.
If you are just tuning in to From the Forest, tonight's show is Floodplains and Forest with resource educator Brent Ghosh. He's with the Ulster County Cornell Cooperative Extension in the Ashokan Watershed Stream Management Program. Brent, we got about a minute left. For someone who owns a little slice of stream and they want to do some tree planting, what's one to three trees you think they should plant or shrubs?
So sycamore is a really good tree for having the riparian area. Hemlocks are great too, although unfortunately, they're, as we mentioned, they're at risk from the hemlock woolly adelgid. I know we put white pine in a lot of places too, although that's usually incorporated more on the periphery between the riparian zone and the more upland area. I would highly recommend putting willow stakes in. And, you know, for your listeners who, like, you know, me when I first started, I thought every willow was a weeping willow, right? Kind of the more tree type plant. That's not the type of willow we're talking about. We're talking about the willow stakes. It's more of a shrubby type plant. So again, pussy willow, heart-shaped willow. I'm forgetting there's several other species out there that are native to the Catskill region. What's great about the willows is that they provide, you know, one, great habitat for a whole bunch of different, you know, animals there in the aquatic area and riparian area. But their roots are really, really deep roots. They, again, they interlock with one another. They grow really deep into the ground, and they hold the plant in place. So it helps prevent erosion as the water passes over the willows. It dissipates a lot of that energy, keeps the water flowing a little bit slower, so there's less destructive potential behind it. So I would, if it was up to me, again, looking at some of those tree species I mentioned, but I'd also really investigate putting willow stakes in as well.
Well, Brent, we are out of time, and thank you again for coming on. I had more questions for you, but yeah, thanks for coming on, Brent.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and thank you guys so much for having me on, and thank you so much for all the good work that you guys do at Catskill Forest Association.
All right, thanks so much, and take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, if you just missed From the Forest, that was Brent Ghosh with the Ulster County Cornell Cooperative Extension, the Ashokan Watershed Stream Management Program over there in Shokan. And up next is Mostly British with Rick Neblong, and that's all I got. Have a good night.
Good night, everyone.
Was his friend, and the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way, his ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way, getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games in an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river runs down from the forest. Thank you.
WIOX is supported by Pika Moose Restaurant on Route 28 in Big Indian, with a takeout menu available for pickup between 5 and 8 p.m. Wild mushroom risotto, oven roasted, snow